He looked down at the baby and saw her now surrounded in her own gauzy, brilliant cloud of wedding satin. It was smaller than her mother's, but otherwise identical, like her blue eyes and auburn hair. Natalie's balloon string rose from the top of her head in a pure white ribbon that floated all the way to the ceiling and then actually coiled there in an ethereal heap beside the light fixture. When a breath of breeze puffed in through the open window by the stove, he saw the wide white band bell and ripple. He glanced up and saw Helen's and Gretchen's balloon strings were also rippling. And if I could see my own, it would be doing the same thing, he thought. It's real. Whatever that 2 and 2 make 4 part of my mind may think, the auras are real. They're real, and I'm seeing them. He waited for the inevitable demurral, but this time none came. I feel like I'm spending most of my time in an emotional washing machine these days, Helen said. My mom's mad at me. She's done everything but call me a quitter outright. And sometimes I feel like a quitter, ashamed. You have nothing to be ashamed of, Ralph said. He glanced up at Natalie's balloon string again, wavering in the breeze. It was beautiful, but he felt no urge to touch it. Some deep instinct told him that might be dangerous for both of them. I guess I know that, Helen said, but girls go through a lot of indoctrination. It's like, here's your Barbie, here's your Ken, here's your hostess play kitchen. Learn well, because when the real stuff comes along, it'll be your job to take care of it. And if any of it gets broken, you'll get the blame. And I think I could have gone down the line with that. I really do. Except no one told me that in some marriages, Ken goes nuts. Does that sound self-indulgent? No, that's pretty much what happened, so far as I can see. Helen laughed, a jagged, bitter, guilty sound. Don't try to tell my mother that. She refuses to believe Ed ever did anything more than give me a husbandly swat on the fanny once in a while, just to get me moving in the right direction again if I happen to slip off course. She thinks I imagined the rest. She doesn't come right out and say it, but I hear it in her voice every time we talk on the phone. I don't think you imagined it, Ralph said. I saw you, remember? And I was there when you begged me not to call the police. He felt his thigh squeezed beneath the table and looked up, startled. Gretchen Tilbury gave him a very slight nod and another squeeze, this one more emphatic. Yes, Helen said, you were there, weren't you? She smiled a little, which was good. But what was happening to her aura was better. Those tiny red flickers were fading, and the aura itself was spreading out again. No, he thought, not spreading out. Loosening, relaxing. Helen got up and came around the table. Nat's bailing out on you. Better let me take her. Ralph looked down and saw Nat looking across the room with heavy, fascinated eyes. He followed her gaze and saw the little vase standing on the windowsill beside the sink. He'd filled it with fall flowers less than 2 hours ago, and now a low green mist was sizzling off the stems and surrounding the blooms with a faint, misty glow. I'm watching them breathe their last, Ralph thought. Oh, my God! I'm never going to pick another flower in my life, I promise. Helen took the baby gently from his arms. Nat went tractably enough, although her eyes never left the sizzling flowers, as her mother went back round the table, sat down, and nestled her in the crook of her arm. Gretchen tapped the face of her watch lightly. If we're going to make that meeting at noon... Yes, of course, Helen said, a little apologetically. We're on the official Susan Day welcoming committee, she told Ralph. And in this case, that's not quite as junior league as it sounds. Our main job really isn't to welcome her, but to help protect her. Is that going to be a problem, do you think? It'll be tense, let's put it that way, Gretchen said. She's got 6 of her own security people, and they've been sending us turnaround faxes of all the Derry-related threats she's received. It's standard operating procedure with them. She's been in a lot of people's faces for a lot of years. They're keeping us in the picture, but they're also making sure we understand that, because we're the inviting group, her safety is Woman Care's responsibility, as well as theirs. Ralph opened his mouth to ask if there'd been many threats, but he supposed he already knew the answer to that question. He'd lived in Derry for 70 years, off and on, and he knew it was a dangerous machine. There were a lot of sharp points and cutting edges just below the surface. That was true of a lot of cities, of course, but in Derry there had always seemed to be an extra dimension to the ugliness. Helen had called it home, and it was his home too, but he found himself remembering something which had happened almost 10 years ago, shortly after the annual Canal Days festival had ended. Three boys had thrown an unassuming and inoffensive young gay man named Adrian Mellon into the Kandusky after repeatedly biting and stabbing him. It was rumored they had stood there on the bridge behind the Falcon Tavern and watched him die. They told the police they hadn't liked the hat he was wearing. That was also Derry, and only a fool would ignore the fact. As if this memory had led him to it, perhaps it had, Ralph looked at the photo on the front page of today's paper again. Ham Davenport with his upraised fist, Dan Dalton with his bloody nose and dazed eyes, wearing Ham's sign on his head. "How many threats?" he asked. "Over a dozen?" "About 30," Gretchen said. "Of those, her security people take half a dozen seriously. Two are threats to blow up the Civic Center if she doesn't cancel. One, and this is a real honey, is from someone who says he's got a big squirt water gun filled with battery acid. If I make a direct hit, not even your dyke friends will be able to look at you without throwing up," that one says. "Nice," Ralph said. "It brings us to the point anyway," Gretchen said. She rummaged in a bag, brought out a small can with a red top, and put it on the table. "A little present from all your grateful friends at Woman Care." Ralph picked the can up. On one side was a picture of a woman spraying a cloud of gas at a man wearing a slouch hat and a Beagle Boys-type eye mask. On the other was a single word in bright red capital letters. "Bodyguard." "What is this?" he asked, shocked in spite of himself. "Mace?" "No," Gretchen said. "Mace is a risky proposition in Maine, legally speaking. This stuff is much milder, but if you give somebody a faceful, they won't even think of hassling you for at least a couple of minutes. It numbs the skin, irritates the eyes, and causes nausea." Ralph took the cap off the can, looked at the red aerosol nozzle beneath, then replaced the cap. "Good Christ, woman, why would I want to lug around a can of this stuff?" "Because you've been officially designated a centurion," Gretchen said. "A what?" Ralph asked. "A centurion," Helen repeated. Nat was fast asleep in her arms, and Ralph realized the auras were gone again. "It's what the friends of life call their major enemies, the ringleaders of the opposition." "Okay," Ralph said. "I've got it now. Ed talked about people he called centurions on the day he assaulted you. He talked about a lot of things that day, though, and all of them are crazy." "Yes, Ed's at the bottom of it, and he is crazy," Helen said. "We don't think he's mentioned this centurion business except to a small inner circle, people who are almost as gonzo as he is. The rest of the friends of life, I don't think they have any idea. I mean, did you? Until last month, did you have any idea that he was crazy?" Ralph shook his head. "Hawking Labs finally fired him," Helen said. "Yesterday. They held on to him as long as they could. He's great at what he does, and they had a lot invested in him. But in the end, they had to let him go. 3 months severance pay in lieu of notice. Not bad for a guy who beats up his wife and throws dolls loaded with fake blood at the windows of the local women's clinic." She tapped the newspaper. "This last demonstration was the final straw. It's the third or fourth time he's been arrested since he got involved with the Friends of Life." "You have someone inside, don't you?" Ralph said. "That's how you know all this." Gretchen smiled. "We're not the only ones who've got someone at least partway inside. We have a running joke that there really are no Friends of Life, just a bunch of double agents. Derry PD's got someone. The state police do too. And those are just the ones our person knows about. Hell, the FBI could be monitoring them as well. The Friends of Life are eminently infiltratable, Ralph, because they're convinced that deep down, everyone is on their side. But we believe that our person is the only one who's gotten in toward the middle, and this person says that Dan Dalton is just the tail Ed Deep No wags. I guess that the first time I saw them together on the TV news, Ralph said. Gretchen got up, gathered the coffee cups, took them over to the sink, and began to rinse them. I've been active in the women's movement for 13 years now, and I've seen a lot of crazy shit, but I've never seen anything like this. He's got these dopes believing that women in Derry are undergoing involuntary abortions, that half of them haven't even realized they're pregnant before the centurions come in the night and take their babies. Has he told them about the incinerator over in Newport? Ralph asked. The one that's really a baby crematorium? Gretchen turned from the sink, her eyes wide. How did you know about that? Oh, I got the lowdown from Ed himself, up close and in person. Starting in July of 92, he hesitated for just a moment, then gave them an account of the day he had met Ed out by the airport, and how Ed had accused the man in the pickup of hauling dead babies in the barrels marked Weed Go. Helen listened silently, her eyes growing steadily wider and rounder. He was going on about the same stuff on the day he beat you up, Ralph finished, but he'd embellished it considerably by then. That probably explains why he's fixated on you, Gretchen said, but in a very real sense, the why doesn't matter. The fact is, he's given his nuttier friends a list of these so-called centurions. We don't know everyone who's on it, but I am, and Helen is, and Susan Day, of course. And you. Why me? Ralph almost asked, then recognized it as another pointless question. Maybe Ed had targeted him because he had called the cops after Ed had beaten Helen. More likely it had happened for no understandable reason at all. Ralph remembered reading somewhere that David Berkowitz, also known as the Son of Sam, claimed to have killed on some occasions under instructions from his dog. What do you expect them to try? Ralph asked. Armed assault? Like in a Chuck Norris movie? He smiled, but Gretchen did not answer it. The thing is, we don't know what they might try, she said. The most likely answer is nothing at all. Then again, Ed or one of the others might take it into his head to try and push you out your own kitchen window. The spray is basically nothing but watered-down tear gas. A little insurance policy, that's all. Insurance, he said thoughtfully. You're in very select company, Helen said with a wan smile. The only other male centurion on their list, that we know about anyway, is Mayor Cohen. Did you give him one of these? Ralph asked, picking up the aerosol can. It looked no more dangerous than the free samples of shaving cream he got in the mail from time to time. We didn't need to, Gretchen said. She looked at her watch again. Helen saw the gesture and stood up with the sleeping baby in her arms. He's got a license to carry a concealed weapon. How would you know a thing like that? Ralph asked. We checked the files at City Hall, she said, and grinned. Gun permits are a matter of public record. Oh. A thought occurred to him. What about Ed? Did you check on him? Does he have one? Nope, she said. But guys like Ed don't necessarily apply for weapons permits once they get past a certain point. You know that, don't you? Yes, Ralph replied, also getting up. I suppose I do. What about you guys? Are you watching out? You bet, Daddy-O. You bet we are. He nodded, but wasn't entirely satisfied. There was a faintly patronizing tone in her voice that he didn't like, as if the very question were a silly one. But it wasn't silly, and if she didn't know that, she and her friends could be in trouble down the line, bad trouble. I hope so, he said. I really do. Can I carry Nat downstairs for you, Helen? Better not. You'd wake her. She looked at him gravely. Would you carry that spray for me, Ralph? I can't stand the thought of you being hurt just because you tried to help me, and he's got some crazy bee in his bonnet. I'll think about it very seriously. Will that do? I guess it will have to. She looked at him closely, her eyes searching his face. You look much better than the last time I saw you. You're sleeping again, aren't you? He grinned. Well, to tell you the truth, I'm still having my problems. But I must be getting better because people keep telling me that. She stood on tiptoe and kissed the corner of his mouth. We'll be in touch, won't we? I mean, we'll stay in touch. I'll do my part if you'll do yours, sweetie. She smiled. You can count on that, Ralph. You're the nicest male centurion I know. They all laughed at that, so hard that Natalie woke up and looked around at them in sleepy surprise. After he'd seen the women off, "I'm pro-choice and I vote," read the sticker on the rear bumper of Gretchen Tilbury's Accord fastback. Ralph climbed slowly up to the second floor again. Weariness dragged at his heels like invisible weights. Once in the kitchen, he looked first at the vase of flowers, trying to see that strange and gorgeous green mist rising from the stems. Nothing. Then he picked up the aerosol and re-examined the cartoon on the side of the can. One menaced woman heroically warding off her attacker. One bad man, complete with eye mask and slouch hat. No shades of gray here. Just a case of, go ahead, punk, make my day. It occurred to Ralph that Ed's madness was catching. There were women all over Derry, Gretchen Tilbury and his own sweet Helen among them, walking around with these little spray cans in their purses. And all the cans really said the same thing. I'm afraid. The bad men in the masks and the slouch hats have arrived in Derry, and I'm afraid. Ralph wanted no part of it. Standing on tiptoe, he put the can of Bodyguard on top of the kitchen cabinet beside the sink, then shrugged into his old gray leather jacket. He would go up to the picnic area near the airport and see if he could find a game of chess. Lacking that, maybe a few rounds of cribbage. He paused in the kitchen doorway, looking fixedly at the flowers, trying to make that sizzling green mist come. Nothing happened. But it was there. You saw it. Natalie did, too. But had she? Had she really? Babies were always goggling at stuff. Everything amazed them, so how could he know for sure? I just do, he said to the empty apartment. Correct. The green mist rising from the stems of the flowers had been there. All the auras had been there, and they're still there, he said, and did not know if he should be relieved or appalled by the firmness he heard in his own voice. For right now, why don't you try being neither, sweetheart? His thought. Carolyn's voice. Good advice. Ralph locked up his apartment and went out into the Derry of the Old Crocs, looking for a game of chess. When Ralph came walking up Harris Avenue to his apartment on October 2nd, with a couple of recycled Elmer Kelton Westerns from Back Pages in one hand, he saw that someone was sitting on the porch steps with his own book. The visitor wasn't reading, however. He was watching with dreamy intensity as the warm wind, which had been blowing all day, harvested the yellow and gold leaves from the oaks and the three surviving elms across the street. Ralph came closer, observing the thin white hair flying around the skull of the man on the porch, and the way all his bulk seemed to have run into his belly, hips, and bottom. That wide center section, coupled with a scrawny neck, narrow chest, and spindly legs clad in old green flannel pants, gave him the look of a man wearing an inner tube beneath his clothes. Even from 150 yards away, there was really no question about who the visitor was. Dorrance Marsteller. Sighing, Ralph walked the rest of the way up to his building. Dorrance, seemingly hypnotized by the bright falling leaves, did not look around until Ralph's shadow dropped across him. Then he turned, craned his neck, and smiled his sweet, strangely vulnerable smile. Fay Chapin, Don Veazey, and some of the other old-timers who hung out at the picnic area up by Runway 3, they would retire to the Jackson Street Billiard Emporium once Indian summer broke and the weather turned cold, saw that smile as just another indicator that old Dor, poetry books or no poetry books, was essentially brainless. Don Veazey, nobody's idea of Mr. Sensitivity, had fallen into the habit of calling Dorrance Old Chief Dumbhead, and Fay had once told Ralph that he, Fay, wasn't in the least surprised that old Dor had lived to the age of 90. People who don't have any furniture on their upper story always live the longest, he had explained to Ralph earlier that year. They don't have anything to worry about. That keeps their blood pressure down, and they ain't so likely to blow a valve or throw a rod. Ralph, however, was not so sure. The sweetness in Dorrance's smile did not make the old man look empty-headed to him. It made him look somehow ethereal and knowing at the same time, sort of like a small-town Merlin. Nonetheless, he could have done without a visit from Dor today. This morning he had set a new record, waking at 1:58 a.m., and he was exhausted. He only wanted to sit in his own living room, drink coffee, and try to read one of the westerns he had picked up downtown. Maybe later on he would take another stab at napping.
"Hello?" Dorrance said.
The book he was holding was a paperback, Cemetery Nights, by a man named Stephen Dobbins. "Hello, Dor," he said. "Good book?" Dorrance looked down at the book as if he'd forgotten he had one, then smiled and nodded.
"Yes, very good. He writes poems that are like stories. I don't always like that, but sometimes I do."
"That's good. Listen, Dor, it's great to see you, but the walk up the hill kind of tired me out, so maybe we could visit another
"Oh, that's all right," Dorrance said, standing up.
There was a faint cinnamony smell about him that always made Ralph think of Egyptian mummies kept behind red velvet ropes in shadowy museums. His face was almost without lines, except for the tiny sprays of crow's feet around his eyes. But his age was unmistakable, and a little scary. His blue eyes were faded to the watery gray of an April sky, and his skin had a translucent clarity that reminded Ralph of Nat's skin. His lips were loose and almost lavender in color. They made little smacking sounds when he spoke.
"That's all right. I didn't come to visit. I came to give you a message."
"What message? From who?"
"I don't know who it's from," Dorrance said, giving Ralph a look that suggested he thought Ralph was either being foolish or playing dumb. "I don't mess in with long-time business. I told you not to either. Don't you remember?"
Ralph did remember something, but he was damned if he knew exactly what. Nor did he care. He was tired, and he had already had to listen to a fair amount of tiresome proselytizing on the subject of Susan Day from Ham Davenport. He had no urge to go round and round with Dorrance Marstella on top of that, no matter how beautiful this Saturday morning was. "Well, then, just give me the message," he said, "and I'll toddle along upstairs. How would that be?"
"Oh, sure. Good. Fine."
But then Dorrance stopped, looking across the street as a fresh gust of wind sent a funnel of leaves storming into the bright October sky. His faded eyes were wide, and something in them made Ralph think of the exalted and revered baby again, of the way she had snatched at the gray-blue marks left by his fingers, and the way she had looked at the flowers sizzling in the vase by the sink. Ralph had seen Dor stand watching airplanes take off and land on runway 3 with that same slack-jawed expression, sometimes for an hour or more. "Dor?" he prompted. Dorrance's sparse eyelashes fluttered.
"Oh, right. The message. The message is..."
He frowned slightly and looked down at the book, which he was now bending back and forth in his hands. Then his face cleared and he looked up at Ralph again.
"The message is... cancel the appointment."
It was Ralph's turn to frown.
"What appointment?" "You shouldn't have messed in," Dorrance repeated, then heaved a big sigh. "But it's too late now. Dunbun can't be undone. Just cancel the appointment. Don't let that fella stick any pins in you."
Ralph had been turning to the porch steps. Now he turned back to Dorrance.
"Hung? Are you talking about Hung?" "How would I know?" Dorrance asked in an irritated tone of voice. "I don't mess in, I told you that. Every now and then I carry a message, is all. Like now. I was supposed to tell you to cancel the appointment with a pin sticker man, and I done it. The rest is up to you."
Dorrance was looking up at the trees across the street again. his odd, lineless face wearing an expression of mild exaltation. The strong fall wind rippled his hair like seaweed. When Ralph touched his shoulder, the old man turned to him willingly enough, and Ralph suddenly realized that what Fay Chapin and the others saw as foolishness might actually be joy. If so, the mistake probably said more about them than it did about old Dor. Darnce?
What, Ralph?
This message. Who gave it to you? Darnce thought it over, or perhaps only appeared to think it over, and then held out his copy of Cemetery Nights.
Take it.
No, I'll pass, Ralph said. I'm not much on poetry, Dor.
You'll like these. They're like stories.
Ralph restrained a strong urge to reach out and shake the old man until his bones rattled like castanets. I just picked up a couple old operas downtown at Backpages.
What I want to know is, who gave you the message about...
Darnce thrust the book of poems into Ralph's right hand, the one not holding the Westons, with surprising force.
One of them starts, each thing I do, I rush through so I can do something else.
And before Ralph could say another word, old Dor cut across the lawn to the sidewalk. He turned left and started toward the extension, with his face turned dreamily up to the blue sky, where the leaves flew wildly, as if to some rendezvous over the horizon.
Darnce!
Ralph shouted, suddenly infuriated. Across the street at the Red Apple, Sue was sweeping fallen leaves off the hot top in front of the door. At the sound of Ralph's voice, she stopped and looked curiously over at him. Feeling stupid, feeling old, Ralph manufactured what he hoped looked like a big, cheerful grin and waved to her. Sue waved back and resumed her sweeping. Darnce, meanwhile, had continued serenely on his way. He was now almost half a block up the street. Ralph decided to let him go. He climbed the steps to the porch, switching the book Darnce had given him to his left hand so he could grope for his key ring, and then so he didn't have to bother. The door was not only unlocked, but standing ajar. Ralph had scolded McGovern repeatedly for his carelessness about locking the front door, and had thought he was finally having some success in getting the message through his downstairs tenant's thick skull. Now, however, it seemed that McGovern had backslid. "Damn it, Bill," he said under his breath, pushing his way into the shadowy lower hall and looking nervously up the stairs. It was all too easy to imagine Ed Deepnow lurking up there, broad daylight or not. Still, he could not stay here in the foyer all day. He turned the thumb bolt on the front door and started up the stairs. There was nothing to worry about, of course. He had one bad moment when he thought he saw someone standing in the far corner of the living room, but it was only his own old gray jacket. He had actually hung it on the coat tree for a change instead of just slinging it onto a chair or draping it over the arm of the sofa. No wonder it had given him a turn. He went into the kitchen and, with his hands poked into his back pockets, stood looking at the calendar. Monday was circled, and within the circle he had scrawled, "Hung, 10 o'clock.
I was supposed to tell you to cancel the appointment with the pinsticker man, and I done it. The rest is up to you."
For a moment, Ralph felt himself step back from his life, so he was able to look at the latest section of the mural it made, instead of just the detail which was this day. What he saw frightened him. An unknown road heading into a lightless tunnel where anything might be waiting. Anything at all.
"Then turn back, Ralph."
But he had an idea he couldn't do that. He had an idea he was for the tunnel, whether he wanted to go in there or not. The feeling was not one of being led, so much as it was one of being shoved forward by powerful, invisible hands. "Never mind," he muttered, rubbing his temples nervously with the tips of his fingers and still looking at the circled date, 2 days from now, on the calendar. "It's the insomnia. That's when things really started to..."
"Really started to what?"
"To get weird," he told the empty apartment. That's when things started to get really weird.
Yes, weird. Lots of weird things. But the auras he was seeing were clearly the weirdest of them all. Cold gray light. It had looked like living frost, creeping over the man reading the paper in daybreak sundown. The mother and son walking toward the supermarket, their entwined auras rising from their clasped hands like a pigtail. Helen and Nat buried in gorgeous clouds of ivory light. Natalie snatching at the marks left by his moving fingers, ghostly contrails which only she and Ralph had been able to see. And now old Dor turning up on his doorstep like some peculiar Old Testament prophet. Only instead of telling him to repent, Dor had told him to cancel his appointment with the acupuncturist Joe Weiser had recommended. It should have been funny, but it wasn't. The mouth of that tunnel looming closer every day. Was there really a tunnel? And if so, where did it lead? I'm more interested in what might be waiting for me in there, Ralph thought. Waiting in the dark.
You shouldn't have messed in, Dorrance had said. But it's too late now.
Dunbun can't be undone, Ralph murmured, and suddenly decided he didn't want to take the wide view anymore. It was unsettling. Better to move in close again and consider things a detail at a time, beginning with his appointment for acupuncture treatment. Was he going to keep it or follow the advice of old Dor, alias the ghost of Hamlet's father? It really wasn't a question that needed much thought, Ralph decided. Joe Weiser had sweet-talked Hung's secretary into finding him an appointment in early October, and Ralph intended to keep it. If there was a path out of this thicket, starting to sleep through the night was probably it, and that made Hung the next logical step. "Dun bun can't be undone," he repeated, and went into the living room to read one of his westerns. Instead, he found himself paging through the book of poetry Dorrance had given him, Cemetery Nights by Stephen Dobbins. Dorrance had been right on both counts. The majority of the poems were like stories, and Ralph discovered that he liked them just fine. The poem from which old Dor had quoted was called Pursuit, and it began, "Each thing I do, I rush through so I can do something else. In such a way do the days pass, a blend of stock car racing and the never-ending building of a Gothic cathedral. Through the windows of my speeding car, I see all that I love falling away. Books unread, jokes untold, landscapes unvisited." Ralph read the poem twice, completely absorbed, thinking he would have to read it to Carolyn. Carolyn would like it, which was good, and she would like him, who usually stuck to westerns and historical novels, even more for finding it and bringing it to her like a bouquet of flowers. He was actually getting up to find a scrap of paper he could mark the page with when he remembered that Carolyn had been dead for half a year now and burst into tears. He sat in the wing chair for almost 15 minutes, holding Cemetery Nights in his lap and wiping at his eyes with the heel of his left hand. At last he went into the bedroom, lay down, and tried to sleep. After an hour of staring at the ceiling, he got up, made himself a cup of coffee, and found a college football game on TV.